Nobody told me that what we were doing was, as you say, against the rule.
Hello, and welcome to another bumper episode of Oh God, What Now? I'm Dorian Litsky. Let's meet the people who will be raking through the ashes of Boris Johnson's reputation. First up, commentator Alex Andreou. Hi, Alex.
Hello, Dorian.
We will go very far from our shores to begin with. Russian troops are massing at the Ukrainian border. US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has flown to Europe for meetings with Ukraine and the EU before sitting down with the Russian foreign minister. And UK Defence Secretary Ben Wallace has sent anti-tank weapons to Ukraine and written a punchy critique of Putin's ethno-nationalism and NATO blaming. What do you think is the most likely outcome of all this kind of frantic diplomacy but also flexing?
That depends on Putin. The situation is quite worrying because, you know, in classic game theory, it's not just about resources, it's about the level of commitment. And the problem at the moment is that, you know, Putin is throwing everything, physically troops, at the border. And the entire West has basically ruled out any kind of military intervention and are saying, you know, we'll do very harsh economic sanctions. So he's ripped the steering wheel of his car, as it were, and it all depends on whether he's doing it in order to extract some diplomatic compromises and to force the West to a situation where they basically promise not to make Ukraine a full member of NATO, things along those lines, or whether he's doing it because he intends to invade. And if he intends to invade, unless the West commits to a physical presence there, economic sanctions won't do diddly squat, I'm afraid.
Ben Wallace's essay was quite good, wasn't it? Quality content from gov.uk.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, it was punchy, but it's just words. That was the problem when they annexed the Crimean Peninsula, is that, you know, by the time they had established their own government there, the West was still trying to discuss whether to do something. Yeah.
The new German Chancellor, Olaf Scholz, has not confirmed that he would suspend the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline from Russia to Germany if Russia attacked. Merkel was pretty bad over Russia. Friendly slash subservient. What do you think Scholz will? Do you think it's a Germany thing?
I think it's a Germany. I think it's a Germany thing. I think saber rattling, for obvious historical reasons, is not Germany's style. The gas line is actually suspended at the moment since the middle of November because the energy regulator there said it could not continue its approval process until the company, which is registered in Switzerland, transfers its main assets and staffing budget to its German subsidiary. So they're essentially suspending it for admin reasons to avoid this out-and-out confrontation, which I don't think is bad. German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock was in Moscow yesterday meeting with her counterpart Sergei Lavrov, and she said, "We have no choice but to defend our common rules, even at a high, sometimes economic price." That seems to me quite a clear signal that Germany will not put up with a Ukrainian invasion.
Minnie Rahman is from the Joint Council for the Welfare of Immigrants. Hi, Minnie.
Hi, Dorian.
Monday night was good. The House of Lords voted down 14 measures in the police crime sentencing and courts bill that we've been talking about for a while. Did you see that hammering coming?
I mean, it was amazing. I wouldn't say that I was expecting that scale of success, especially because Labour's announcement that they would oppose the amendments did come quite late after the Lib Dems and the Greens. But I think this is really a massive credit to campaigners across the board. And for me, this is kind of where the magic lies when movements come together. You've had all kinds of actors for a long time calling for opposition on this bill. You had the Sarah Everard protests, which were perhaps the beginning of that cycle. And it's ended up with collaboration from civil rights groups and environmental groups. And I think when things align in that way, you have to expect that there will be some chain of reaction, or at least that's the theory. So, yeah, it was amazing. And I was pleasantly surprised.
Dominic Raab said the government will try again, as it does. But which measures can be reinstated by the Commons? Aren't some of the new public order offences dead now? for parliamentary reasons.
Yeah. So the bit that Raab has interestingly come out fighting for, and which has had a lot of coverage, was turning misogyny into a hate crime. And he said the Law Commission doesn't agree with that. And that was an amendment that was tabled by a crossbench peer. I think regardless of that, the problem with the government amendments is the way that they were added to the bill, which includes the public order offences. So because they introduced them after the bill had passed through the Commons, MPs weren't able to vote on them, which actually gave the Lords a little bit more power than usual. So the Lords were able to fully remove them from the bill, which means that the government can't put them back in during ping pong between the two houses. But what they could do if they really wanted to is put in a whole new bill and essentially start again with those amendments included from the beginning. But I think if they did that, that would bring a whole new dimension of opposition. So it's a kind of watch this space thing.
I suppose they have to decide how much they want to invest in every single one of these measures.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it would be quite risky given how this has gone down in the first place.
Our guest this week is the chief features writer of the Financial Times Weekend magazine and writes a weekly satirical column on politics and culture. He's also the author of How to Love Animals in a Human-Shaped World. Welcome, Henry Mance.
Oh, hello. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot for coming in. The government's just announced the end of Plan B restrictions, including the mask mandate, COVID passports for large venues and advice to work from home. You're not working from home. You're here in the studio. Do you think that that's a sort of solid policy supported by the science or a kind of political, you know, measure in a very difficult time for them? Because Scotland and Wales are also doing things like reopening nightclubs.
Yeah, I think the trajectories are within a pretty, you know, small margin either way. I mean, whether you go more cautious like other parts of the UK have or slightly more easygoing free living like the Conservatives want to take England, then I think you can see a pretty clear trajectory. Countries that have had the Omicron wave seem to be going through in sequence this sort of peak of infections. I think it's sort of looking fairly optimistic from a pandemic point of view. And I think actually what's interesting is that, you know, if you're a Tory, you think, oh, that will coincide with a rush of popularity. But actually, it's a bit like D-Day. You know, straight after D-Day, which was once what the sort of end of pandemic restrictions was likened to. You know, you have D-Day, you've got this great sort of victory that flows from that. And actually, then people say, right, we've been through this, and now we thank you very much for all the job you've done, or not. But now we're ready to change leaders. So there isn't a sort of gratitude in the process. And I think, likewise, the Tories, having thought that they've earned credit from the vaccine rollout and opening things up now, will actually not get much of the bounce that they're expecting, that people's gratitude will be very limited.
Yes, because we're not post-COVID, but politics feels much more post-COVID.
Yeah, I mean, look, the big thing today was Prime Minister's questions at midday on a Wednesday, and then you had the announcement of restrictions being eased shortly after that and sort of basically overshadowed. So, like, it's like the political circus is happening rather than the health and safety announcement, which may matter more to people's life. I think what really matters to people right now is people who are thinking about going back to the office or thinking about resuming their normal lives, going to the theatre, going to cinema, going to restaurants. What really matters is whether you have to isolate for 5 days, because people are super cautious if they think they're going to have to, they have the potential of a whole week being wiped out. And once that comes to an end in March, I think there are going to be quite sort of significant changes in the way people live their lives.
Meanwhile, in what I think we should still call cyberspace, you recently interviewed Facebook VP Nick Clegg in the Metaverse, their virtual reality platform. He and Meta believe the future of technology is the virtual world, where presumably we could all shelter from the next pandemic. You interviewed him across a digital table. Do you agree? Was it a thrilling experience? not Nick Clegg's bit, but the
It was quite weird. So, like, we were meant to meet in person, and he was coming to to lobby European politicians. So we were meant to meet here, and then Omicron hit, and he's like, "I'm not coming." And then they suggested, "Look, well, we're obviously big onto the metaverse. Let's meet in. Let's meet using the VR headsets we've got." And I logged into this meeting room and I found myself sort of separated by a seat from him. Someone who was organizing the meeting said, "Can you just move a seat closer to Nick? Just click this button and you'll virtually, your avatar will move closer." And I did that. And then when I arrived in the seat next to him, I felt like I was in his personal space. So there was like a really weird thing of like, okay, we're just pixels here, but I feel too close to you in this boat. I mean, it might have been in the Clegg thing, who knows? But look, it's like watching like a really early version of the internet. It's pretty crap. But I think like there's obviously limitations with people staring at their phones all day. I mean, I'm sort of pretty skeptical of people like Meta, but, you know, I mean, something's going to happen there. The amount of money that Microsoft and Google, Facebook and others are throwing into the metaverse, it's coming whether we like it or not.
Could you potentially then in the future interview Nick Clegg in something like the sort of the Doctor Strange sequence in the latest Spider-Man movie, where it's just like things folding in on themselves, kind of whizzing through kind of like mad geometry? Like, why have a, when you've got the entire metaverse at your disposal, why have a table?
Be quite distracting for the interview itself. If you're running from a universe that's caving into itself.
Yes.
It make it more exciting for you, but I feel it would make for a worse interview, is what I'm saying.
Did you read that thing about the Danish journalist who went to a brothel?
Is this a joke?
Did an interview with people, with customers, while having sex with one of them. And it was like, okay, that wins the interview of the year prize anyway. So, like, yeah, you've got to be more innovative these days. And I think maybe the metaverse gives you a platform.
If you have to choose between the two, I would go for the metaverse.
So the real limitation is, by the way,
you thought sitting next to Clegg was bad.
Yeah, there was one stage where I was trying to work out like abuse rules within the metaverse. So I said, could I just walk over and punch you? And then I realized that this was a kind of quite offensive thing to say to someone who's obviously suffered a bit of abuse. I feel the major limitation of all those headsets at the moment is they can't pick up on facial expressions. So your hand movements they've got, and they've got really well, and that's great for gaming and stuff. But facial expressions, you can't see when you say something whether someone actually is offended or amused or whatever. But that will come. They will put it in. They will build the sensors. They will do it.
Well, it's very exciting. I'm sure nothing can go wrong with this technology. This week on Carry On Up the Johnson, it's all happening. The Sue Gray report into Partygate is imminent. A full-blown backbench rebellion is wondering whether to force a vote of no confidence. And Bury South MP Christian Wakeford has defected to Labour. Is the PM a dead man walking? Plus, when in doubt, Tories attack the BBC. We discuss Nadine Dorries' latest culture war salvo and the broader debate about how to fund the Beeb in the age of streaming. And in the extra bit for Patreon backers, we're handing ourselves the reins for Auntie. If we were in charge, what would we change? First this week, the wheels are coming off Boris Johnson's clown car. Alex, we'll get straight in. You're our unofficial PMQ sketch writer. what happened today?
So there was a lot of noise. I mean, the Tory backbench has tried to create a deliberately chaotic atmosphere because they know he's got no serious answers to serious questions. So all they can do is turn it into panto. But I feel that there's something shrill, there's something brittle about their energy, like that they shout, the more they shout, the more they're glancing sideways at, is anyone holding the, you know, the starting pistol for this leadership content? There's something quite empty and fragile about it. Johnson, for his part, I would say rallied a bit. I mean, it's all relative. I say rallied in comparison to the interview he did the day before with Beth Rigby, where he looked like he was about to run to his bedroom, belly flop onto the bed and say, no one gets me, I hate you.
Well, Tory MPs are telling journalists that he's been in tears.
Yeah. like every sitcom out of ideas, I think his notion of rallying was basically a best of clip show. It was stitching together his favourite lines from Times back then. I mean, the problem mainly for him was that his performance was bookended by two very significant events. So right before he stood up, Christian Wakeford, 2019 intake Red Wall MP, defected to Labour, actually walked across the aisle. And right at the end, on the very last question, we must have been thinking, I've done it, I'm home free. David Davis stood up and called for his resignation in the strongest possible.
Well, he did the classic, because obviously sketch writers love, like, when you bring out, I suppose, like the classic, like an old hit. You cover an old hit.
Yeah.
And he did In the Name of God, Go.
Yes.
Which was originally Oliver Cromwell, the OG. And then made more famous by Leo Amery to Neville Chamberlain. And then Johnson said he'd never heard the quote, which implies that maybe he didn't write his Churchill book himself after
I'm
all.
Sure that was in jest, I would think.
Now, Wakeford is best known For calling Owen Paterson a cunt in the Commons lobby, an outburst he later blamed on codeine. So he sounds like a lot of fun. What else do we know about him?
Well, he's the MP for Bury South. He's 37.
Yeah.
He's 37. He used to sell insurance for a living. As I understand it, he tried to become a Labour councillor before joining the Conservative Party. So maybe he's Labour curious, has always been. It was quite a peculiar... I mean, he won the constituency by 400 votes. Mm. It was literally 0.8%. And it was a quite peculiar constituency because it was Ivan Lewis's old seat. And you may remember he was suspended over some sexual misconduct allegations, then ended up resigning over the anti-Semitism row, then ended up advising his constituents to vote Conservative. So it really was quite a weird little seat. The Conservatives, of course, are calling for a by-election. And Labour are saying, I think very cleverly, well, the Prime Minister is welcome to call a general election and put that hypothesis to the test. So
we'll actually be talking about the by-election issue later.
Yeah.
Minnie, reportedly the last straw for Wakeford was the Whips threatening to take away his seat with boundary changes. It's also said that Johnson has failed to launch a charm offensive on restive MPs, whatever that might look like. Is he sort of at a loss how to win back the rebels? It seems like they don't know what to do with all these angry people.
Yeah, I mean, just on Wakeford, you know, I think that point that Alex made about having a majority of only 402 in a red wall seat, I think that has played quite a major role in why he's crossed the floor back to Labour. And it makes sense in light of recent polls. So I was reading one of these kind of anonymous comments from MPs about Boris Johnson. And one of these MPs said that Boris Johnson wasn't actually taking the threats of 1922 committee's letters seriously at the weekend, and was actually quite shocked by the Whip saying, you know, oh, shall we try and rally support? I think that's quite fitting for Boris to not take something seriously. But at this point, you know, the rebels are so diverse, it would actually take a kind of a House of Cards style Machiavellian genius to convince them all of them to continue to support him and to promise them things for doing that. You know, you've got the Red Wall Tories who are worried about their constituents and how they feel about the next election. You've got the anti-lockdown people who are pissed off and just kind of using this as ammunition. And then you've got the, you know, I like to call them the Tories with an occasional conscience group who know that Partygate was totally unacceptable behaviour. And actually, it's really hard to bring that group of people together. And I think that's quite visible in this kind of like frantic, how can we appease everyone stance that Johnson is taking at the minute.
The interesting twist to me is that Wakeford had been considering defecting for months and Labour had actually been talking to him for quite a while, not just pre-Partygate, but pre-Paterson. Mm-hmm. Do you think that this is to do with somebody, like they said, a Labour-curious MP with a very narrow majority, therefore a one-off? Or do you think this reveals a sort of depth of dissatisfaction that perhaps people didn't notice before these scandals?
Yeah, I mean, I find it very hard to understand Tory MPs' decision-making processes. You know, there's things that I would have been a dissident for long before this. Mm. But I think what Henry said earlier about this kind of moment of D-Day moment, you know, we're coming through the end of this crisis, or the end is at least somewhere in sight, and how does that impact on what people say? You know, I think you can't go through a pandemic and Brexit and not have people who are annoyed at things that you've done either way, but people have probably kept those feelings quite below the bar, or to the best of their ability below the bar, because we've been going through a big crisis, a health crisis. And I think now that we're sort of returning to normality and people are looking ahead at elections and the public mood is changing, MPs are probably going to start making more decisions that don't require the backing of a crisis PM.
Henry, so we've got David Davis now. We're following the Scottish Tories commemorative Brexit Toby Jug, Andrew Bridgen. And most importantly, it seems the 2019 intake, which I mean, it's not the same as the Red Wall, it's often associated with. Well, once seemed to be sort of thirsty loyalists who owed their careers to Johnson. Now government sources are branding them feral, yeah. saying they basically weren't domesticated by physically being in the Commons during lockdown, so they just don't know. They're like shitting everywhere and they can't be controlled. It's so different to the assessment that was being made of this intake in December 2019. Like, what's going on with these guys?
That is really interesting. I mean, I love these quotes because they're just like not helping. There was another one I saw, which is... Martin Vickers asking, Tory MP, being asked why he wasn't putting in a letter. And he says, well, I'm going to wait for the Sue Gray report. Even a serial killer gets their day in court. And it's like, don't say that. It's the party leader. You're trying to help. I think it's hard to know. It's up to quite a small number of people. But look, the electorate itself is very volatile at the moment, isn't it? Over the last few years, people will have voted for two or three parties in many cases. And I think MPs are not really averse to that themselves. I mean, of course you have people who go into politics who believe absolutely everything that one party does and or are completely committed to that, like, I don't know, Alan Mack, just you see your loyalty as your ticket to the top. But there are others who would just sort of believe some things, believe others, could have gone either way. I mean, and there have been always been. I mean, Rory Stewart, could have joined another party had the other party been in the ascendance when that was happening. And I think also, MPs are just so much more tied to their constituencies and the feedback they're getting than people who have been in that. Than certainly people who were elected 40 years ago. But I think people like, if you think about Owen Paterson or something, they've had a relationship, they've sort of risen above it, they're above the sort of day-to-day fray of what constituency feedback is. I wonder if you're a newer MP, you're much more exposed to that and much more dependent on it.
Especially from that red wall, because, the straightest reading of that is that massive voter movement that we saw in the last election, where loads of seats went to the Conservatives, and they didn't go by a little. There's no big swings, and now you look at the polling and they've swung right back the other way, and you might just be one of those people that basically bought Johnson's shtick that, will be different now and will be a part of the people now.
Well, it does make you think, this maybe reflects what the voters are thinking, because there was this idea, this is a sort of permanent or at least a long-term shift.
Yeah.
But if the MPs that owe their seats to Johnson are sort of doubly furious and maybe feeling, rather than gratitude, just a sense of betrayal, like, oh, you've landed me in it, then it does make you think that the theory that all these Labour voters going Tory, and once you go blue, you never go back kind of thing, might not hold up. And actually, a lot of people might feel like they've been conned.
Yeah.
And nobody likes to feel they've been conned.
I can't remember who said it. It was an American sort of political theorist that was talking about the Obama selection. And they were saying that the measure of converting a voter is to get them to vote for you in two general elections in a row, that it's only then that you can consider them a sort of Republican voter or a Democrat voter, because once might just be I've had it with you, I'm going to kick you.
Henry, apart from Michael Fabricant and his amazing hair, who is on Johnson's side? Like, who do you see defending him, not in a kind of dutiful, like, I'm preparing my leadership campaign way, but in a sort of genuinely like, come on guys, this guy's great.
Nadine Dorris.
She loves him, doesn't she really does love him.
And also the other person that I see often there is Zach Goldsmith, and like there I do feel a bit torn, because Zach Goldsmith, throw tomatoes at him for quite a lot of stuff, but like he has an environmental argument there, which is, whoever comes in is not going to be as committed to the green agenda as Boris. You may think getting Boris out is a way of then getting a, pro-green government in, i.e. Labour-led. Mm-hmm. But you're going to have a year or so where it's Rishi Sunak or Liz Truss saying, a bit expensive that, why don't we reduce fuel duty or whatever we do, or build a couple of airports or whatever it might be. So, I think he's really committed. But these are people who were brought back into the fold, really, by Boris. And I think, if you're a 2019 intake, you don't see, you might think you owe your seat to Boris Johnson, but you don't feel that he's going to decide of your political career. I think that is really interesting that and this whole thing about them being domesticated by the older MPs. I mean, the older MPs rebelled against Cameron, rebelled against May, And so what, now they think they're in a position to tell the younger ones, don't rebel against Johnson. It's not how we do things around here. I mean, it's ludicrous. It doesn't make any sense.
Half the time with fabricants on TV, I think they're trailing the new Fraggle Rock to be entirely honest.
He's a wonderful character. Brings joy to the nation. Now, it seems almost like it's kind of weird. This would have been like our top story, the sort of party allegations that since last week's episode, more have come out.
Mm.
It really is just an endless Woodstock. Most damagingly, the one on the eve of Prince Philip's funeral.
Yeah.
Dominic Cummings insists that Johnson knew about the drinks in May 2020, which, of course, he says he did not, and was actually warned not to let them go ahead. And he's going to be speaking to Sue Gray.
Hmm.
Meanwhile, Dominic Raab on Sky News accidentally admitted that a party took place. poor old Dom. Every Dominic Raab interview is a trial.
I repeat my assessment of Dominic Raab. He's always like Sam in Quantum Leap when he's just jumped into a new body and he's trying to work out, who am I, where am I, and how should I answer?
And I don't
questions?
Think this is... I would not bring this up if I thought it was an actual speech impediment, but he has a painful kind of... It's just like every fucking syllable is like a high wire act, and it goes, I don't know where the sentence is going, I don't know what I believe, I don't know what I'm about to accidentally admit. Maybe a party.
I just don't know why they still let him go out and do this stuff. He just makes so many mistakes.
There's a flop sweat. His voice is sweating.
They ain't got that much choice at the moment, do they? In terms of senior cabinet people going out there to defend the PM. So
is he banking on, because he said lying to Parliament was a resignation offence. So is he banking on good news? I mean, are the government sort of, Do they know something about Sue Gray's report that we don't? Or did he just panic?
I think Johnson has assured them that he will be cleared. I think that's what it is. So that's the only proviso under which they will go out there to defend him, to say, let's wait for the report, and then, you know, because they've been assured that it's going to be much better. I mean, that is what someone of Johnson's psychology would do. He'd play for an extra 5 days, you know, to try and work out a way to get himself out of the pickle. And I can completely see him doing that.
Everyone says, what will Dominic Cummings say to Sue Gray? For me, what will Martin Reynolds say? Will he say, I did consult with Boris Johnson before I sent the email, or he did know, or people came and had a word with me and I had a word with Boris? I mean, like, he's got the Prime Minister's future in his hands there. And I think when Boris Johnson reassures other people that it's all going to be fine, he doesn't know what other people are telling Sue Gray. And so it's too late to avoid the iceberg. You've just got to say, we're not going to sink. And that's the only way of keeping it together.
He's pledged to tackle this drinking culture at Number 10, which, according to people who previously worked in Number 10 before Johnson,
wasn't a drinking culture. It wasn't a thing.
And it's very much like the kind of meme of the guy dressed as a hot dog. With the hot dog car has crashed into the window. Yeah, and he goes, we've got to find the guy who did this.
It's a paper dragon created by Johnson so that he can slate at a later date if he gets into trouble and look tough and decisive. But I think my instinct as someone who worked in the civil service for a very long time is that I would be astonished if there isn't a paper trail. I would be astonished if senior civil servants, Peston is reporting in the New Statesman today that there was an email. So the person, the sender of the email wants to remain secret, but Peston has seen an email from someone senior in Downing Street to Reynolds saying, we should cancel this. I appreciate the kind sentiment, but it breaks the rules. The idea that Reynolds then just took that decision when we know that Cummings also had misgivings about the party, it just seems to me astonishingly uncivil service. Like, your instinct as a senior civil servant would be to create a paper trail and get it cleared by someone more senior than you. And there is only one person.
Well, the Sue Gray report seems like probably going to be an emergency podcast situation.
Yeah. But for her too, I suspect.
She can come on if she wants. Minnie, the darker side of this is that at the beginning of the week, the government opened their emergency red meat locker and immediately attacked the BBC and, of course, migrants crossing the channel. Do you think that that's had any sort of impact? Is this the kind of, is this the most sort of brutally obvious example of using channel migrants for pure political expediency? Or is this just what they do all the time?
I mean, yeah, they do it all the time, but I could have absolutely predicted that this would be the response. You know, we actually had conversations about this last week, or, you know, as a joke in the office, when is it going to come up? When are migrants going to come up in response to Party 8? So, you know, I think anyone could have predicted that. And actually, someone who is not me should go and plot on a graph how these things align, you know, crisis, migrants, and see how close they are together. I don't think it is working this time as it has previously, just because I think that they've exhausted this option in the last year. You know, they've talked about channel crossings so much, and there's been, you know, very recent tragedies in the channel that I think the national public might be starting to zone out of it a little bit. I mean, there's probably still a lot of interest in and around Kent, where it's more visible and people are worried about people dying on the beach outside their house. But I don't think it will have the same cut through at the minute, or at least it hasn't felt the same to me. And it feels kind of tired and useless at this point.
So wrapping up, I suppose, to go back to Johnson, Alex, rebel MPs are clearly sort of unsure whether to strike now, because under the rules, if Johnson won a vote of no confidence, there couldn't be another one for a year.
Mm.
But I wonder if some of the MPs who think that this is too soon might prefer too soon to a year with a wounded PM, you know, in which he wins a vote of no confidence, but not emphatically. Then nobody can challenge, then they're stuck with him for another year. What do you feel? I mean, nobody, this, it sort of changes all the time. Do you feel like those letters are going to go in this week? We're going to get that challenge?
You know, I do, because I have the, you know, those games that you play in the arcades with the 2p pieces or the 10p pieces. Mm-hmm. It just feels like everything that goes in the pot just pushes a few off the edge. Mm. And every poll that comes out is worse for them. And they have small minorities to defend. And it is, the conduct itself is pretty indefensible. So it just feels like a few of them will drop off the edge every time. Now, whether Johnson wins that vote or not, I don't know. I will point out that, you know, Thatcher went at a time when she was supposed to be adored by the parliamentary party, bar a few exceptions, and the membership. So if she didn't survive this kind of challenge, I don't know how someone who, by all accounts, has zero allies in Parliament. I mean, he has people who really love him, like Nadine Dorries, genuinely love him. But he doesn't have people who are his allies politically, who see him as someone who represents their wing of the party, their way of thinking. And it's very, very difficult to see a situation where he survives it.
Henry, just to finish this section, until very recently, I'm talking like November here, the pundit consensus was that Johnson was scandal-proof and all in Teflon, and all his flaws were priced in, and sort of everything. It was almost like a Trumpian argument, like whatever he did wrong, it was like, ah, but people like it when he does things wrong. That seems not to be the case now. What do you think that sort of consensus misjudged?
I mean, I think the peak of kind of misunderstanding Boris Johnson was after the Hartlepool by-election, which it was actually their peak in the polls as well. But everyone was like, look, this shows the beginning of a cycle of Tory dominance, of Johnson's dominance. We've got a decade in power here. And if I blow my own trumpet, but I did write on the day after that, like, all the people who have done well in these local elections and in the Hartlepool by-election are basically incumbents. And it's like a post-pandemic or mid-pandemic attitude by the electorate that they're in crisis mode and they don't want to change horse. And the other thing that's obviously changed is that we've gone from scandals, which are quite difficult to understand or quite abstract.
Like PPE procurement is the one.
Certainly. I don't think we've heard the last of that. But that's all. And I think also people felt that the opposition were talking down to them. They were saying, the government has made some mistakes in the pandemic and we would have been far cleverer. And they were playing, I told you so. And Keir Starmer had that problem at PMQs where he sounded like your boss telling you were a bit crap at your job and he would have done it much better if he just didn't delegate anything to you. And I don't think that was a great look. Whereas now everybody can say, oh, I didn't have a party. And so the scandal's that much easier. The pundit consensus was to look back on what had happened and to think that would inevitably go forward. And instead of realising that actually globally, incumbents were doing pretty well in that moment.
Mm-hmm. It is an amazing thing, given that we are living, as we could say, in really chaotic, unprecedented times. The pundit mistake that keeps happening over and over again is to look at whatever is happening now and think and just predict that's going to continue.
Well, the other thing is real wages. And it's like where people feel it in the pocket. Like in 2017... One of the things we won't talk about is that real wages were going down at the time of the general election. There was a real squeeze. And that's what's happened over the last few months. So, I mean, I think it's also people will always attribute their discomfort to other things. But if they're being squeezed in the pocket, that is going to give them less benefit of the doubt towards the government.
Well, our But Your Emails this week is kind of a little coda to the main topic. This week, Greg asks, hot from Christian Wakeford defecting from Tory to Labour and anticipating a change of Prime Minister, should MPs who change parties face a by-election? And should a PM who's put into office by the membership, not the voters, be required to face a general election?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is such an interesting question. So thank you to Greg. And it actually, I went back and forth on it a couple of times. You know, I think the question is, it's quite context specific. You know, in the last few years, there's been so many changes in government leadership outside of elections and such big political things like Brexit that it's felt almost ridiculous that there hasn't been a general election at the same time as feeling like there's too many general elections.
Not another one!
So, I mean, I think if you try and take it out of the context and let's say there's like a normal time in politics and a leader has to stand down because of something like illness or family commitments, you know, I don't think that should necessarily be an election matter. And actually, I think what this comes down to is about democratic reform and trust in government processes, which have really been abused in the last few years. If I was going to start on democratic reform, the kind of things that I would put in place would be like recall of your MP so that you could apply something like defections to that. Because if, you know, constituents say, actually, my MP is defected and now I want a local election, then fair enough, they could do that and then move on to kind of electoral reform in general. So I kind of had to take it out of the picture that we're currently in and think about what the big things are that are needed.
I'm inclined to say no. I mean, it's probably quite a bit of money involved and you get really low turnout. And also, one MP doesn't really matter very much. I mean, like, in the scheme of things, they're still going to represent you on the constituency issues that they represented you before, but it's not like they've got a swing vote in Parliament to decide which way things go. They're just, I mean, and actually, I think the history of most of these people is that they, you know, they're set fire to their career when they change parties.
What about the PM, though? What about a PM who changes midway?
Oh, what? So as in like Major Johnson?
Yeah.
Actually, you know what? The history of that is really interesting as well. I remember when Theresa May was in power and everyone was saying she's not going to have a general election for 4 years or whatever. I went back and I looked at the history of when there'd been a change in power. And actually, prime ministers generally don't last very long without a general election. And so I think in a way it just doesn't seem the biggest problem in the system.
I
suppose I agree on by-elections. I mean, I suppose just to look at the rules, it's like it's the individual who gets elected, technically. Mm. Now, you miss it. Actually, of course, it's really the party that gets elected. And as we've seen, a lot of the time when those kind of Tory exiles stood, you know, even really popular people like Dominic Grieve, whatever, they got hammered by the Tories. So the people do vote for the party, but kind of technically, you vote for the individual. And I'm fine with that. And as Henry points out, this allegation of, there's this allegation of careerism. Do you remember when all those people formed TIG and then Change UK? And it was like they're careerists. And like all of them finished their political careers and were more likely than not to do so.
Yeah.
And so I don't quite see this sort of idea of just like that this is that, you know, that defecting or leaving your party to go independent is some kind of like cynical, self-interested move. Often it just seems like we're going to have a load of people really angry with you. You possibly lose your seat in the next election. I don't really see a kind of a particularly ethical or democratic argument for why you would have to have a by-election.
Hmm. My first instinct was to say, yes, there should be a by-election or a general election if there's a change of PM. But then, actually, I think the party system and the whipping system is actually a corruption of the separation of powers. And we shouldn't be doing anything that encourages the idea that you elect a party and you elect a prime minister. Yeah. We shouldn't be encouraging that. We should be encouraging people to think the opposite way, that to look into the individual they're casting their vote for rather than the rosette. And so I think that's the more mature democratic option.
I agree.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Next this week, in last week's Mail on Sunday, Culture Secretary Nadine Dorris, big Bojo fan, took on that classic Tory bugbear, the BBC, announcing that this licence fee announcement will be the last. The fee has been frozen for the next 2 years, and a future funding model is TBC. Minnie, this announcement's clearly been rushed out as part of what nobody is now calling Operation Save Big Dog. Which is a shame, because I love, for the 5 minutes that Operation Save Big Dog was a thing, I quite enjoyed it. It is quite weird to say you're abolishing the licence fee without announcing a new funding model. Do you get the sense that there is a plan here, but they're just kind of going to make it a surprise?
Yeah, I as we talked about with the pivot to like talking about migrants, you know, I don't think any of these proposals were very well thought through. I don't think they're necessarily policy coherent. They're rushed. The government is panicking and they're trying to do anything they think can appease their backbenchers. They know that, you know, if there's one thing the Tory right hate more than an illegal party, it is the BBC. And the truth is, the BBC is not perfect. It gets criticism from both sides. It's an amazing institution that we should be grateful for, but there are things to think about in terms of reform. Now, if she was serious about reforming the funding model, it's very obvious. You know, you would look at it and you would go, okay, it's not a progressive model, so let's think about ways to fund it in a fairer way. And it's quite obvious that because she hasn't done that and there is no plan for a funding model, it's more a political statement, which isn't very well thought through.
Hats off to her, though, for sort of framing it as removing a financial burden from the hard off. A time of rampant inflation, rocketing fuel prices and an imminent VAT rise.
Yeah, but yeah. Phew.
But, you know, that your £157 a year, that...
It's not going to go up to £162.
Yeah, that's yeah. the... yeah. That's you can use the £6 you've saved there to pay 0.1% of your fuel bill.
Yeah.
Alex, the licence fee is being squeezed, I think, from two directions. You've got the older people who many of you didn't want to pay, younger people that say they don't need it because they're not, you know, they're not using the services or they don't have a television. What do you think would be the best solution for the BBC? There's a few different models and hybrids as well that have been suggested. Do you have an instinct of something that would seem fair rather than a sort of an act of like political sabotage?
I think there's a syllogistic error in there that you could transpose to health, to social care, to any kind of public service. I think we always ask, what can we afford? The first question should be, do we want this? Does it perform a useful function? The next question should be, what do we want it to do? The question after that should be, how much will that cost? And it's the very last question of that thread that is, how do we raise that money? And I think this is quite an important point in our public debate, actually. Not, you know, a country with its own tax-raising powers and its own fiat can afford anything, actually, hypothetically. The question should always be, what do we expect the state to do with us? What is the state better at doing en masse, more efficient at doing? And how do we fund that, rather than starting from this notion that we have a limited pot of money and, you know, it's in my gift as the state to say, here, you take 1% and you take 3%. I don't think that's the right way of going about any of
this. So you're just saying directly state-funded?
Look, there are many models. I mean, in Greece, you pay for the state broadcaster on your electricity bill. There's like a small levy on your utility bill. In France, you pay for it by ring-fenced direct taxation, as I think you do in Germany. You know, every country has a public broadcaster, actually. It's not. It's a silly debate. It's a silly confected debate, but I think it does hide a real issue, which is, how do we think of public services? Do we think as a limited pot of money that we throw scraps to this thing that's nice and that thing that's nice? Or do we want to reimagine what we want the state to do for us because it does it better and cheaper and in a more neutral way, and it doesn't try to squeeze profit out of us? What makes sense for the state to do, and how much will that cost? The rest is actually follows quite simply.
Henry, supporters of the BBC tend to sort of catastrophise the, you know, the end of the licence fee. Can you see a way in which, I mean, this has been suggested, sort of it's subscription, but also sort of government grant to sort of fund the sort of these really important services that maybe people are not going to, you know, pay for, and it would, you know, it's got such a strong brand, it would be able to sort of monetize things at the moment that it can't. Could you see a kind of rosier post-license fee scenario?
I want to be really, sort of optimistic about this, or sort of innovative. I mean, I don't think so. I mean, I think one of the problems with subscription, if you're going to have free-to-air, it just costs hundreds of millions of pounds to implement a system whereby you can exclude people from watching it. I mean, I think the attacks on the BBC are incoherent. I think, you know, on the one hand, they want it to be a real national patriotic broadcaster to play the national anthem. On the other hand, they want it to be like Netflix. They want it to be less political, but they politicise it by, you know, insisting that there are lots of Tories at the top of it. So, no, I'm not. I mean, I do think the one thing that the BBC needs to do at the moment, if you look at the figures about how much, on average, an average person in the UK, how much TV they watch, it's incredible. Hours and hours. And that's because there are some people who watch it all day. And that's how the linear model is set up. And I think the future of the BBC is to serve those people, those older people, a bit less, and to focus on being and producing really high quality streamed content, and to be streaming first and not to be like linear channels first. I think ultimately squeezing the budget is not the way to go.
I remember when the left hated Nick Robinson from the Today programme for being a former Tory activist. And now the right hate him for being a lefty who's always giving the government a hard time. You talk about these sort of confected attacks. There was a good book that came out a year or so ago called, I think, the War on the BBC. Do you think there's anything the BBC can do that would quash accusations of left-wing bias? Or is it so important to the right that they'll just, you know, they can't let go of that idea?
It's a really good question. I personally think it's just become an article of faith, a bit like believing whatever other institution is weighted against you. And it's sort of particular. It's particularly powerful at a time when you have this education split in the electorate that fears that, you know, and so you feel that these well-educated people in the BBC are all sort of smugly sitting in North London drinking, you know, oat cappuccinos, and like they're not your people. But I think like that's not, that just doesn't reflect the breadth of BBC content. I mean, okay, so there are programmes when I tune on to the BBC, like Frankie Boyle's A New World Order, which I find absolutely hilarious. Like sometimes I find the lack of balance there a bit disconcerting, and it's just difficult. Like comedians just tend to be left wing, and like jokes of left wing jokes just seem to be funnier. I mean, could they scrap programs like that? But then like Antiques Roadshow is kind of like an inherently traditional program where you have sort of colonial artifacts displayed as like part of Britain's natural national history. So I kind of feel like you just have to take the rough with the smooth.
No, they can mention any kind of royal coverage, which is like an orgy of sort of nationalism.
Yes, yeah.
But could they not balance that Antique Roadshow with Antiques Woke Show, where the hosts are constantly telling people that their grandparents were racist?
Well, you bring your grandparent along, it's like, no, that is only worth £1. That grandfather, he's seriously racist.
You bring in some artifacts. You know, my grandfather bought this back when he was serving overseas, and they just go, it's fucking racist trash, and then they confiscate it. It's just a way of evening things out.
That's how the.
Like... Can I be the host of that?
But on Nadine Dorries, who today I saw a clip of her saying that she was amazed that young people watch programs on YouTube. It's like, this is seriously the person deciding the future of BBC. Yeah. But like John Whittingdale, who's pretty, like, who I think is instinctively on the right of the Tory party. Mm-hmm. I mean, he says that the licence fee is still the best thing out there. And I think anyone who looks at the question seriously enough just doesn't believe half the crap. I mean, the newspapers have got a vested interest in bashing the BBC. It's sort of an exhausting debate because I don't think there are any interesting answers to it. It's just, you know, the status quo is pretty much where things should be. You need to change a few things.
Do you, Alex, think it gives Labour a good line here, sort of, you know, save the BBC?
Do you know, I think it does, because everyone has complaints about bits of the BBC and everyone wants the BBC to reform in some way. I think there are very few people that wanted to disappear. And I think a sort of a political party who went out there with a campaign to save the NHS, save the BBC, vote for us, I think they do quite well. And they do quite well with older voters with which Labour has had a problem getting a hearing. I think it's a big mistake, actually.
I'm not putting money on this actually happening in 2027.
No,
it won't happen.
I don't know about you, for a number of reasons.
Mini success hosting Antiques Roadshow. Save the BBC.
Sleep a hit.
It's almost the end of the show, so it's time to take a quick look at stories that we think aren't getting the attention they deserve in Under the Radar. Minnie, what's your Under the Radar story?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's super under the radar, but I'm really excited about the 4-day work week pilot that has just launched in the UK. It's got 30 companies taking part, goes on for 6 months, and it's led by an organisation called 4-Day Week Global. It will be tied to other pilots around the world. But I think this will be one of the biggest positive changes that can be tied to the pandemic. You know, I don't think we'd be anywhere near this pilot if the pandemic hadn't happened. And I'm really hopeful that the results will be, you know, everyone who can should be on a 4-day work week.
Yeah, fantastic. Alex?
So Byline Times have put together a long read as part of a collection, and I would encourage you all to go and look it up, about the sort of horrific point at which the hostile environment for migrants meets the hostility that there is and has existed for a long time against homeless and destitute people. And they're looking at stories of basically EU migrants who reach out to a charity or to a state organization for help because they're down on their luck and they end up sort of being rounded up and deported. As obviously an EU migrant that has been homeless at some point in the past, I have a very personal stake in this. People's lives are not linear. You know, you might be down on your luck after 4 decades of paying tax, or you might be down on your luck very temporarily and then end up, you know, with a big company that employs loads of people 5 years later. We are citizens of this country and we deserve the same help and support as everyone else. So several charities are mentioned there and I would urge everyone to support them.
I'm going to go for this little story that the Treasury has written off £4.3 billion of the £5.8 billion that was stolen from its emergency COVID schemes, including furlough, the self-employed income support programme and Eat Out to Help Out. It expects to get only a quarter of that back. But that is out of a total of £81.2 billion they paid out overall.
Yeah, I mean, we can afford the BBC, I'm tempted to say. You know, if we can give Dido Harding $37 billion for literally nothing,
we can
afford the BBC.
You see, I'm actually ambivalent about this because I feel like if you are paying out $80 billion to all these schemes to basically stop people's business going under and stop people from kind of, you know, economic catastrophe, if this is the percentage of just that just goes to, like, frauds, I don't know whether it's like, I mean, it's obviously a lot of money. Don't get me wrong, but I just wonder whether when you're doing this sort of stuff in haste on such a large scale, mm-hmm. whether you can ever kind of get to the point where there's basically no fraud or minimum fraud or all the fraud that you get back. So it's sort of a weird one because it feels scandalous that the judge is just like, oh, well, I guess we're never getting that back.
5% is not a small percentage. You know, of all the funds.
I think there's a lot in America as well.
But if those were the figures on any kind of welfare benefit, you would have every fucking newspaper jumping up and down.
Yeah, it's the hypocrisy, isn't it? It's just, you know, fine, if they can write that off, they can write off other things too that they probably should have and haven't.
Well, we go back to the sort of the magic money tree, which didn't exist and then did exist and then doesn't exist again and just basically pops up only when required by the Conservative Party.
That's why it's magic.
That's why it's magic. I mean, that's the clues in the name. I didn't realise that was why it was magic. I see. It's just you have to give it a special Tory call and then it pops up. Henry, what about you?
Yeah, I'm slightly struggling on this, but two things caught my eye this week. One was the sort of slightly sad, I'm sorry, they're a bit offbeat, but one was the slightly sad plight of puffins in the North Sea, which seem to be doing badly for reasons we don't really understand. And so I always think, like, of just these iconic things that I see on my books all the time that I'd be very sad if they disappeared. And the other was a New Yorker article about the thawing of Siberia's permafrost. When I was speaking to someone about this a few years ago, they were trying to explain it in scientific terms and then they just went, we're so fucked. And I just felt like the sort of the release of greenhouse gases, which is, in the soil in Russia, is something that we haven't really reckoned with. So I kind of, if people are interested in that, then that's it. I sometimes feel less bleak after I read these articles because at least you know what you're facing up to. It's like George Orwell saying, you know, down and out in Paris and London, you know, you all your life you fear going to the dogs, and once you're there, it's sort of a slight relief. Anyway,
this is good. This might cheer up Boris Johnson. I was scared my career was going to end in failure and disgrace, and now it is. I have no fear.
It's quite funny, like, because he'll go through the Operation Red Meat phase, but then when it's really over, like, Theresa May in her last months did, like, a net zero target and all this. And then he'll do the stuff that he really wants to be remembered for. And so there will be this sort of, you know, there might be a slightly softer phase of him in the next couple of months.
There won't.
There won't.
I don't know. I'm intrigued by this article. Yeah, the green case of Boris Johnson.
No, I'm sorry. Don't get the wrong idea here. See you at the nearest coal mine.
And that's the show. Thank you to Minnie.
Thanks, everyone.
Alex.
Thank you.
And our guest, Henry Mance.
Thanks so much for having me.
Stay tuned for our extra bit exclusively for Patreons. You'll hear a preview after our theme song, Demon is a Monster by Corner Shop. And a thanks to our latest backers.
It's a big thanks from me to Paul Watkins, Ken Scott, Kate Anstey, Jerry Blunt, Greg Surmage, Diana Dudgeon, and David Beck.
Best wishes from me to Callum Findlay, Greg Weiberg, Janet, Megan, Mark Luscombe, Hannah Bond, and Carolyn Crawler.
And thanks from me to Christopher Eden, Christine Smith, Rob Mitchell, Tom Ritchie, Rob Hassite, Mike Smart, and Julian Hiles. See you next time.
Oh God, What Now? Was presented by Dorian Linsky with Alex Andreu and Minnie Rahman. The group editor was Andrew Harrison, the lead producer was Jacob Jarvis, and the producers were Jacob Archbold, Jelena Sofronievich, and me, Alex Rees. Art direction by Mark Taylor. Oh God, What Now? Is a Podmasters production.
On the extra bit for Patreon backers this week, the next in an ongoing series where we give ourselves unreasonable amounts of power without responsibility. If we woke up as the Director General of the BBC, which parts of the corporation would we change, introduce, or scrap entirely? Who would be our first Director General? Alex.
To be honest, I would actually scrap all the things that are really popular and do really well, because I think that's actually where content is duplicated. I don't think there's any reason at all for BBC One to exist or Radio One. I think the media landscape is crowded with channels that do that kind of context.
But they put adverts in, mate. Have you seen adverts?
Yeah. Well, not.
Have you heard radio adverts?
Not when you're streaming.
Yeah.
No, but seriously.
Jingles are so bad.
Look, it's a serious point. Its value is in the stuff that commercially wouldn't be viable for anyone else to do. And so I don't get the point. I think Netflix is perfectly capable of doing the next Vicar of Dibley, and Sky is perfectly capable of doing Mrs. Brown Boys. I really don't get why I should be paying for Strictly Come Dancing. That's the bit of it that I don't get, even though it's hugely popular, because I don't think it's uniquely the purview of a national broadcaster. I think news is...
That was a trailer for the bonus bit in this week's podcast. If you'd like a little bit more Oh God, What Now every week, without ads and a day early, then sign up to back us on Patreon for as little as £2 a month. You'll also get our new weekly mini-cast, Oh God, What Else, out every Monday morning, exclusive to backers. Your support really does help us keep going. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.
It's a busy world out there. Once you've woken up and got on top of all your WhatsApps, your texts, your emails and your DMs, then you've got another pile of stuff to get through. The news. Honestly, who's got the time? That's where Papercuts, the brand new podcast, comes in. Papercuts is your fast, funny tour of all the best bits of the papers, from the biggest scoops to the weirdest headlines to the definitely not made up showbiz gossip. And it's out every weekday with me, Miranda Sawyer, and a host of guests, including tip-top comedian Marcus Brigstock. Marcus, what's your favourite thing about Papercuts?
It's the puns. It's obviously the puns. I mean, when we go through the papers and you see what creative beauties the people who work, particularly in the tabloids, have come up with. Often I think it's pun first, then story for them. They're like, I've got one. Find a story to match this. But it's a really fun part of the podcast to see what they've come up with every day.
Especially the Daily Star.
Oh, the Star. Proud to love animals.
So if you want to be on top of the news and have a laugh while you're doing it, get Papercuts every day on your favourite podcast app. We're out around lunchtime, Monday to Friday. Perfect for a bit of me time in the middle of a busy day. That's Papercuts. We read the papers so you don't have to. Thank you.